Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 10, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the rise and decline of American religious freedom, sponsored by our Religious Liberties Practice Group. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two law professors, including the author of the new book, The Rise and Decline of American Religious Freedom, Professor Stephen D. Smith, who is the Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of San Diego School of Law. So we're going to start off by hearing from Professor Smith, and then after that, we're going to hear remarks and a little bit of discussion with Professor John Anazu from Washington University School of Law. So I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. So without any further ado, Professor Smith, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Christian. And I appreciate the Federal Society for sponsoring this discussion, and I thank John Anazu also for taking the time to participate in it. Looking forward to it. This is the first teleforum I think I've participated in, so I'm interested to see how it will go. It's been suggested that I take a few minutes and explain a little bit about what the book is about, so I'll do that. I can't do it by stating what the argument of the book is exactly because it's not devoted to a single argument. I might actually give a sense of the overall purpose of the book by saying that the title that I originally had in mind for the book was not the one that it currently has. That was one that Harvard University Press pretty much insisted on, that I accepted. But the title that they didn't like, but that I actually preferred, was American Religious Freedom, the Revised Version. And I begin the book by saying that I think discussions of religious freedom in this country tend to operate against the backdrop of what I call the standard story. Not everybody tells the story in the same way, of course, but I think there is a pretty consistent story about religious freedom that we learn and that we use. And for these purposes, in the book, I divide it into five chapters. So I'll just briefly say what those chapters are. The first chapter I call Americans as Enlightened Innovators. The idea is that the founders of our country were visionaries in the matter of religious freedom who departed radically from all past practice with respect to matters of religion, and in particular departed from the Christendom and the Christian heritage, which is associated with intolerance and persecution and so forth, and that they had a radically new vision. Second chapter I call the Monumental Meaningful First Amendment. This chapter tells how this radical new vision was embodied in the religion clauses of the First Amendment, which are thought to have contained some kind of visionary principles like governmental neutrality in matters of religion or secular government or something of that sort. The third chapter I call the Long Dark Interlude. This one isn't always told. This is a sort of a darker chapter in the standard story, but the idea is that from the time of the founding up through about the middle of the 20th century, the commitments that had been made in the First Amendment were largely forgotten or ignored, that there was instead a de facto establishment of Protestant religion in the country. There were still occasional prosecutions for blasphemy. There was still religious persecution and religious discrimination and so forth. But this leads in the standard story to the happier fourth chapter, which tells how the modern Supreme Court, beginning in the 1940s and especially in the 1960s, began to remember and redeem the promises that had been made in the First Amendment and intervene fairly aggressively in the nation's political life to eliminate school prayer, to eliminate governmental subsidies to religious institutions, and so forth. The final chapter that's sometimes told as part of the standard story I call the conservative religious retreat from constitutional principles. That is, in the standard story, it's often thought that the commitments of the First Amendment and the achievements of the modern Supreme Court in the 60s and 70s is somewhat in danger because of the rise of the religious right, which is said to be basically opposed to the wall of separation of church and state and to some of the constitutional principles, thereby threatening the uniquely American commitment to religious freedom. I think, and I say in the book, that there is a lot of truth in this standard story, but there's also a lot that is misleading or partial or, frankly, inaccurate. And so the book is devoted to trying to offer a revised story, and for each of the chapters of the standard story, I try to give then a different chapter, which in some cases contradicts or in other places at least complements and tries to make more complete the standard story. So I'll just briefly say what the ideas of each of these chapters is. With respect to the idea of Americans as radical innovators, I suggest that in fact the element of continuity in the American commitment to religious freedom is stronger than the element of change from the past, that in fact it's more accurate to view the American commitment to religious freedom as a kind of retrieval and consolidation under the circumstances of the New World of classical Christian commitments. Let me elaborate just a little on that. Christianity, I suggest, was different than the paganism of classical antiquity in a couple of very important ways. One is that it had a kind of dualism. You know, this is captured in Jesus's admonition to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. They're sort of two realms and two different kinds of authorities, both legitimate, both valid, but with different jurisdictions, you might say. The second radical change from paganism is the idea that religion has a very important, perhaps the most important aspect of it in Christianity, is internal faith, belief, that sort of thing. And that can only really be voluntary and sincere, otherwise it's not efficacious. Now, these changes were not immediately implemented, and they've been very imperfectly honored over the centuries, of course. But over the centuries, I think, in Christendom, they began to be elaborated and recognized. So the dualist theme is especially important, I think, in the medieval campaign for freedom of the church, or libertas ecclesiae, as they called it, the idea that the state should not be able to intervene in the appointment of bishops, the formulation of doctrine, that sort of thing. The church has a kind of independence. That, I think, can be seen as an antecedent of our modern commitment to separation of church and state. That campaign largely failed for a time, at least, when we get to the 16th century in England, Henry VIII's takeover of the church and so forth. But I suggest that the commitment migrated, and especially in Protestant thought, migrated into what I describe as sort of the idea of the freedom of the inner church, of conscience. The conscience came in Protestant thought to assume some of the functions that the church, the outward institutional church, had served in Catholic thought. And at this point, the commitment also to inner, voluntary, sincere religion became very prominent in the defenses of people like Roger Williams and John Locke and so forth of religious freedom of conscience and religious toleration. And I suggest that the American commitment to religious freedom can be seen as an American implementation of these classical Christian themes, not so much as a rebellion against the Christian past. I'll try and be a little briefer about the second chapter, which just is that argues, as I did at more length in an earlier book called Foreordained Failure, that the founders, when they wrote and adopted the Establishment Clause, were not really intending to do anything radical. Rather, they were intending to preserve the status quo in the sense that they were simply trying to ensure that the adoption of the new Constitution would not deprive the states of authority over religion. That's where jurisdiction over religion would continue to be. It would not be transferred to the new national government. It was only later, I suggest, that the Establishment Clause in particular came to be interpreted as adopting principles of religious freedom that would be binding on the national and state governments. The third and fourth chapters of my revised account are quite different than those in the standard story. I think that the period between the founding and the middle of the 20th century was not a long, dark interlude, although human imperfection was obvious there, as it is throughout human history, but that it is more accurate to see that as a time in which Americans worked out something that I call the American settlement, that was in fact theoretically inelegant, but practically very valuable response to the fact of religious pluralism. I probably should say just a little about that because it's necessary for what happens after to understand what happens afterward. So for the present purposes, I will try to explain the American settlement by noting one important fact and one important distinction. The fact is that Americans from the beginning and still, I think, have divided in their understandings of the nature of the American republic into, this is obviously simplifying, but into sort of a sort of providentialist camp and a more secularist kind of camp. The providentialist camp, which would include people like Washington, John Adams, Abraham Lincoln, see our history as subject to the overarching guidance of Providence. They often see religion as important in promoting civic virtue, but they try to insist that that the government should not take stands on sectarian, religious, or theological issues. A really nice expression, I think, of this view is the often mocked, but I think quite wise statement of President Eisenhower, who said that our form of government has no sense unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is. I think that's a nice expression of the sort of classic providentialist view. The secularist view, on the other hand, is not necessarily and typically not anti-religious, but it does insist on a more distinct separation of just religious and political or governmental functions. To counter Eisenhower's statement, we might quote Justice Hugo Black, who said, both religion and government can best work to achieve their lofty aims if each is left free from the other within its respective sphere. I suggest that this sort of view has also had its prominent spokespeople, including Jefferson, Madison, Andrew Jackson, and others. Now, that's the fact, that we've been divided, again, this is oversimplifying, but into more providentialist and more secularist sorts of understandings with adherents of both. Most of us are actually a little bit in each camp, but I have to simplify here. The distinction is between hard and soft constitutionalism. Hard constitutionalism is probably what we understand today, the sort of written or articulated judicially enforceable constitution. Soft constitution is more like what Larry Kramer describes as popular constitutionalism. It consists of basically the understandings, practices, and so forth that constitute us as a people. Soft constitutionalism then would not necessarily be judicially enforceable, but it also would not be the same as just ordinary politics, people just voting their preferences and so forth. It would consist of deep values and commitments that we think constitute us as a people. I suggest that the American settlement, though it had a hard constitutional element, you could not have a national church, you could not have an inquisition. But for the most part, it consisted of a sort of soft constitutionalist commitment to religious freedom in which both providentialist and secularist views were welcome participants. They had a place at the table. Neither one was constitutionally established as the orthodox position, with the other being the heretical position. And this, I suggest, inelegant though it was a kind of ingenious and admirable response to the problem of pluralism. Let me just briefly explain it this way. The lesson, I think, of early modernity following the Protestant Reformation was that if you have competing factions, in those days Catholics and Protestants basically, and if the government is going to choose one of them as the official and preferred position, you're going to have a great deal of conflict over that because nobody wants to be the loser, you know, the banished heretic. In the American situation, the competing factions, the salient factions, have not been so much Catholic and Protestant as providentialist and secularist, and the American settlement in its soft constitutionalism ensured that neither one would be the constitutionally preferred orthodox position. Both would be welcome. There'd still be a lot of messiness. Different positions would prevail in different times and places. You'd have school prayer in one school district and not in another, etc. But neither one was the constitutional provision. And for the most part, this avoided the kind of serious strife that was evident in the early modern wars of religion. So if we move to Chapter 4, when the Supreme Court began to intervene in the situation, especially in the 1960s, I suggest, what it was doing was not so much remembering commitments that had been made in the First Amendment and vindicating them, but rather undoing the American settlement by taking the secularist position and elevating it to the status of constitutional orthodoxy, while relegating the providentialist view to the status of basically a kind of constitutional heresy insofar as public policy is concerned. And the result was not violent wars of religion, you know, as in the 16th and 17th centuries, but a series of culture wars that appear to be ongoing and may be becoming more intense with the passage of time. This sort of leads to the final chapter, and I'll try to be quick about this. What's the current state of religious freedom? The standard story suggests that it's embattled because the religious right rejects constitutional commitments. I suggest that this is correct insofar as it suggests that religious freedom is in a precarious condition these days, but the source of the danger is different in my view. It's that the basic commitment to religious freedom and the classical rationales have been deemed inadmissible, and this development has combined with some developments that Doug Laycock, I think, has in particular explained and explored well in several articles and talks that he's given, that have led to a situation in which the commitment to religious freedom is now widely rejected, in much of the academy, at least. A common idea, perhaps even the dominant idea in the legal academy, I think, is that religion is entitled to the same kinds of constitutional protections that other ideas, ideologies, institutions receive, freedom of speech, et cetera, due process of law, and so forth, but that there really is no justification today for giving special constitutional protection to religious freedom. And so Doug suggests that for the first time in, I think he says, like 200 or 300 years, the very status of religious freedom as a constitutional, as a special constitutional right, is in some jeopardy, is being energetically contested. I don't think that we can foresee, and I don't predict, you know, what the outcome of this contest will be, but it is very much a contest that we're all involved in, I think, at the present time. That pretty much is a quick, I think, account of my five chapters in my revised account, and any of them might be issues that that people might like to discuss. But with that, I'll again thank John for being willing to comment on this and turn the time over to him to do that.
Great. Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with all of you on the call today, and especially to have the opportunity to comment on Steve's book. Steve is one of the smartest and, importantly, one of the clearest writers in this area of the law. You might not like all of his arguments, but you at least understand what he's saying, and that's no small thing. I want to register at the outset two points where Steve and I agree. The first is that we both think religious liberty is crucial to our society and its future existence. The second is that I share Steve's pessimism, which didn't come out so much in the narrative he just gave, but comes out more in the book, but I share his pessimism about the current trajectory of religious liberty. And I'm not sure, actually, that Steve is pessimistic enough, and that's where I'd like to focus the majority of my comments today. I largely agree with the historical critiques that Steve offers, and so I want to focus more on kind of where we are and where we're going. And I want to start with one of the themes that Steve takes up in the book, this idea of the freedom of the church. I'll mention that Steve is not the only one who was disappointed when Harvard rejected his proposed title when I had seen an early draft that had the revised standard version, which led me to an article that I wrote with a soft critique of Steve called The New Revised Standard Version, and that has less of a punch with his former title now gone, but it's there, out there. I want to suggest that Steve's focus on the freedom of the church is right in a sense, particularly in the sense that churches have played historically and theoretically an important role in Western society and Western political thought. And indeed, most of our most important institutions today, including hospitals and universities and social service organizations, would not be where they are today without the churches that birthed and nurtured them. And that's a fact that's too often ignored in some of the rhetoric of our time. I also think Steve is right to note in the book that the court's recent decision in Hosanna-Tabor reinvigorates something like the freedom of the church, if not expressed explicitly in that way, then something like it. But my worry is that this idea, this concept is fundamentally a theological one, and that legal appropriations of it will put pressure on the theological category, and that perhaps some aspects of translation will be ultimately unworkable. I don't mean to say that all translation is impossible, and so, for example, basic anti-establishment principles are going to extend the freedom of the church to other faith traditions, to include institutions like mosques, synagogues, and temples. That's an easy one. There's also a second kind of translation, which we see from the Lutheran school at issue in Hosanna-Tabor. Religious organizations that are not formally houses of worship will still fall under something like the freedom of the church. And in addition to secondary schools, we can think of soup kitchens and outreach ministries as perhaps fairly obvious examples. But I think we're going to see, if we haven't already, much more contested arguments about larger and more powerful institutions tied to churches, most notably universities and hospitals. And those arguments, when they come, are going to introduce a conceptual fuzziness around the freedom of the church, including why, for example, it might protect an elementary school but not a university, even if both educational institutions are structured hierarchically in a similar way. I think there's also a related challenge for religious organizations unaffiliated with churches, most notably here in the emergence within American evangelicalism of parachurch ministries that are only loosely connected to an ecclesiastical structure. Whether the freedom of the church should be extended to these non-church institutions raises additional questions of law, theology, and ecclesiology. And we've already seen a federal appellate court extend the ministerial exception to a parachurch ministry in the recent Conlin decision out of the Sixth Circuit. I'd be interested in Steve's thoughts about these kinds of applications and whether they ultimately put pressure on the underlying doctrine. So, for example, consider whether the ministerial exception will protect a church from the loss of tax-exempt status resulting from its ministerial employment decisions. And if so, whether expansions of the doctrine to a broader set of institutions, like perhaps universities and hospitals and parachurch ministries, negatively affects the possibility with respect to tax exemption. So that's my first set of reflections and questions for Steve, whether he might be too cheery about the possibility of the translation of the freedom of the church into legal doctrine as we go forward. The second set of observations is about the cultural salience of religious freedom. And here I think that Steve's pessimism is not quite strong enough. So we heard Steve mention Doug Laycock's arguments for religious liberty, as well as Doug's increasing sense that those arguments are losing salience, at least in the legal academy. And I think actually that they are losing salience outside of the legal academy as well. So Steve in his book suggests that support for these arguments for religious liberty is contingent and might be undermined, but he thinks, quote, many Americans surely still find those rationales persuasive and admissible. I'm not so sure, and I want to walk through Doug's arguments to see what we can make of them, but suggest that the undermining has to a large extent already happened both in and outside of the legal academy. So start with the first argument that Doug offers, that attempts to impose or suppress religion have led to a great deal of suffering because people care so deeply about religion, and therefore it's better to avoid this kind of suffering. I think that's right, historically, and the framers' familiarity with the widespread suffering from these governmental attempts would be quite an important consideration. But if the government's methods of control and suppression were more effective and less deadly than in a previous era, then that argument might lose some salience. Doug's second argument is that because religion matters so much to believers, some will fight or kill or even die for the sake of their beliefs, and that's better avoided. But it might be the case that large segments of believers have become captive to other values. Say maybe they've become more American than they are Christian, and in that case, far fewer might be willing to suffer or die for their values. And then the final argument that Doug offers is, and Steve recounts all of these in his book as well, that religious beliefs are, at the end of the day, of relatively little importance to the government. And I think that that's often the case with belief, but when theology, liturgy, and church governance collide with laws enacting governmental norms, including, for example, anti-discrimination norms, then the effects of those beliefs will become increasingly important to the civil government. And I want to suggest that each of these three changes is arguably already unfolded in contemporary American society. In other words, each of these three reasons offered to justify protections for religious liberty arguably lacks persuasive power in today's constitutional debates. I think, too, there's an even more challenging reason that complicates the contingent nature of these arguments, and that's one that Professor Mark Tushnet flagged almost 30 years ago. Tushnet wrote, "The constitutional law of religion is founded on a tradition that we no longer fully understand." He observed that despite both liberal and Republican influences on the framers, the overwhelming success of the liberal tradition means that the Republican tradition is far less available to us than it was to the framers. Notions like the common good are not cognizable within the liberal tradition. And as Tushnet recognized, we have no coherent way to recover them. This loss of shared convictions as a diagnosis seems right to me. We disagree more and more about fundamental questions like truth, meaning, and ethics, or even whether those categories retain any coherence. Now, I don't mean to suggest that religious freedom as a generalized or abstracted ideal has lost its cultural or political salience. In fact, if you look at the international rhetoric from our government, we continue to advocate for the importance of religious freedom around the globe, and polling data internally suggests that most Americans value religion and religious liberty in a general sense. But there's also a sense, I think, in which fewer people today recognize the immediate and practical need of legal protections for the free exercise of religion. The primary reason might be that religious liberty has been a victim of its own success, and many of the religious impositions and laws of a past era are just not with us. We don't enforce blasphemy laws. We don't force compelled statements of belief. We don't impose taxes to support the training of ministers. These changes mean, as a practical matter, that many Americans no longer depend upon the free exercise right for religious liberty, and they're largely free to practice religion without government constraints. We can add to that a growing number of Americans who are either actually or functionally non-religious and may therefore have no need for free exercise protections. This group is still relatively small, but it's not insignificant, and it's growing. And more importantly, this group has moved from almost imperceptible in the late 18th century to significant today in a way that it's no longer possible to ignore non-believers in framing normative and legal religious liberty arguments, particularly in cases implicating the Establishment Clause. That reality is evident in the growing recognition that even non-sectarian prayers are incapable of accommodating atheists. Both the religious and the non-religious may be less inclined to worry about the contested boundaries of the free exercise right, and that's always where the doctrine plays out. They might view the outer limits as either unimportant or perhaps even antithetical to other ideological interests, and Steve certainly nods toward this at the end of his book. The upshot, though, might be that cultural views about the importance of free exercise might weaken even as more generalized and abstract notions of religious liberty remain high. I think this pressure on the salience or nature of religion as a category raises another question that Steve takes up in the book and that he mentions briefly today, which is whether it makes more sense to expand this idea of religion to a broader category. And one possibility is the notion of conscience. Steve notes at the time of the framing, the free exercise of religion was virtually synonymous with freedom of conscience. And here I just point out as a purely linguistic matter that the word conscience would have been a better fit than religion for the trajectory of belief that we have witnessed in American society. It would have more easily encompassed all kinds of non-religious but deeply held commitments that we see today. Of course, the framers had no way of knowing this, and we need not blame them for our current predicament. But I do think the broader linguistic capacity of conscience over religion might also suggest why courts have moved to other First Amendment provisions to supplement or perhaps even replace protections for religious groups. Concepts like speech, assembly, and association do not depend on religion-specific justifications. We don't need Professor Laycock's contingent propositions to justify them. I also think that, and this is important culturally and politically as well as legally, that these other rights are likelier to resonate with the broader culture than arguments rooted in the free exercise of religion. The pluralist argument that undergirds these other rights draws from a history with greater current cultural appeal than the free exercise right. And I don't mean to suggest that pluralism is not also implicit in religious liberty. It is, but that these other rights are more broadly appealing. And in fact, we see in speech, assembly, and association protections for many progressive movements of particular relevance, protections extended to gay social clubs and gay student groups during the early gay rights movements. Those historical parallels might have implications in the current context, which, as Steve notes, confronts traditional religion and contemporary secular egalitarianism in a way that sees those traditions as, at some deep level, fundamentally incompatible. And finally, revisiting Steve's book made me wonder about the recent decisions in Hobby Lobby and Holt against Hobbes. Both were wins for religious liberty, but both were statutory rather than constitutional decisions. In one sense, the focus on statutes is entirely unsurprising given the state of constitutional free exercise law. But it's not clear to me that statutory protections by themselves alter the direction of Steve's narrative of decline, particularly in light of the ideological incompatibility that he identifies between liberty and equality. For the kind of directional change that would truly alter course, we would need the court to re-examine its reasoning in the 1990 Peyote case, Employment Division against Smith. And without such a change, a more appropriate title for Steve's book than either The Rise or Decline or the revised version might be The Beginning of the End of American Religious Freedom. Thanks again for the opportunity to be with you, and I look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Well, thanks, John. Now, I think I'm permitted and should probably take the opportunity to just respond a little bit to some of what John said, but he said a lot of quite important things, I think, and so I'm not going to make any attempt to give a point-by-point response. I would say I'm not used to being outflanked on the pessimist side or something. So this is a little bit of a new experience for me. There was a recent issue of the Pepperdine Law Review in which three scholars, all friends of mine really, responded to the book, Andy Koppelman, Nelson Tebbe, and Paul Horwitz, and they made some very perceptive comments, but you might say that the general tone was that I had made a lot of good points in the book. They agreed with a lot of it. Why was I so pessimistic about everything? Life's good. The world's going well. I'm overstating it a little bit, but it seemed fairly complacent to me in the attitudes expressed there. I actually think that the attitude that John has conveyed now is more suitable and cogent for the times we're in. That would be, to my mind, true. And it raises a lot of good questions, I think, about sort of the way forward. It did occur to me that I might quickly notice then, and I was just jotting these down on a piece of paper as John was talking, the alternatives that I think maybe are before us right now and that we're trying to make some choices among them. If you see the world as I do and as John, you know, has just described it. So one alternative, I think, is to say traditional commitments to religious freedom as a particular right and to freedom of the church are embattled, but what we ought to do is defend and, if necessary, revive those commitments. Try to do that. And in doing that, we might try to revive and defend the admissibility of something like the classic theological rationales, or we might try to translate those into or supplement them with more secular rationales, with the pitfalls that John has described, I think, with that kind of strategy. Or we might try and do both, but that's one alternative, sort of dig in and try and defend these classic constitutional commitments. A second alternative, and one I think John inclines to favor, is one that would say the special commitment to religious freedom is maybe largely lost, but there are other associated freedoms to that are more defensible today, and we ought to focus our energy on those. freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of association. John has a really nice book about freedom of association, except that he ties it to freedom of assembly. Those are the ones that have a better chance of being defended because they don't depend so much on theological rationales. A third alternative, I think, and I hear this a fair amount when I give talks to different bodies of Christians. I think John does more of that than I do, but I hear some of this, where I think of this as in Richard John Neuhaus's disparaging term, the back to the catacombs. You know, basically the battle is lost, and we just need to find places of refuge where we can sort of disengage to some extent from American life and live, live our own life. I think there are really hard choices to be faced along these lines. I sympathize with number three, but I'm not inclined at this point to advocate it. For one reason, I don't really know where the catacombs are. With modern technology and a state and government that is more powerful in many respects than governments have ever been in the past, I'm not sure where the places of refuge are. I don't think you have to choose between one and two. You can favor both of them. But I'm not inclined to abandon one in favor of two. In other words, just the generic secular freedoms of association and speech. In part because I think without the commitment to freedom of religion, those other freedoms are pretty vulnerable as well. Historically, I think they have grown out of the commitment to freedom of religion to a large extent, and I don't know how solid they are without it. And I would say in the end that the church is an association, but it's not just an association like other sorts of associations. And I think we need to understand both the what it contributes and the special needs that the church has, the special claims, I should say, maybe, that it has. And so I'm inclined to think that in going forward, we need to do what we can to understand, maybe educate people about and defend some of those commitments. And I would offer, I'm not optimistic about this. I can't say I'm really cheerful and expect, success in this, but it seems to me that it may be the best alternative. And towards the end of the book, I might just mention, I say, the whole history of the church has been full of surprises. There have been a lot of times, I think, in which the future looked pretty dark. If you go to, the 9th and 10th centuries, the church was in pretty bad shape, and no one would have anticipated the Gregorian reforms of the next century, I think, that revitalized in some ways the church. If you go to even, the late 18th century in this country, I don't think you could have anticipated the revivals that would occur in the 19th century that would in many ways reinvigorate Christianity and bring out new forms of Christianity, such as Mormonism, for example, my own faith. So I don't know what surprises the future may hold for us, but I don't think we should discount the possibility that things may happen that we don't foresee. But in any case, these are certainly important and difficult choices that people will be facing, and I think John's comments on them are very perceptive and helpful.
That's great, Steve. If I could just make one brief comment back to, I'll quote Steve from a more recent article just to underscore his own point with his own words, where he writes, "I emphatically do not mean to lapse into any sort of historical fatalism. Much remains open and undecided," and I would agree with that. And just to respond briefly to one point, I think on the religious liberty doctrinal arguments around free exercise, much of my reservation about those arguments is the interplay between culture and legal and constitutional doctrine. And I do think that there is a way in which the 1990 decision in Smith remains vulnerable. There are briefs even this week being filed suggesting that the Supreme Court should revisit the Smith decision. I think that's right. I think that'd be the proper thing to do under doctrinal analysis. And without some kind of resolution, we have this nagging tension between the Smith decision and the recent ministerial exception decision in Hosanna Tabor, and that tension makes the doctrine pretty volatile and unstable. So I'll agree with Smith that we don't have a predetermined outcome, but unless and until that tension gets resolved, I am less confident in the free exercise route.
Okay. All right. So I think both John and I, if there are questions, happy to talk about them. Or if we have a lot we can talk about between ourselves if we want to go forward that way too. So.
Excellent. Well, first off, thanks to both Professor Smith and Professor Anazu for a great opening. We've got about 20 minutes left, so and a lot of people on the line. So we'll go to your questions now. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key. So if you'd like to get in line and ask a question, press star and the pound key. All right, looks like we had our first question jump on the line.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. It was a very rich discussion, and I'd like to try and put it in a factual context, if I may. Just in the past week, I was reading an article that, assuming the facts are correct, the article described a situation dealing with a Navy chaplain who, according to the article, was forced to resign because his counseling of a sailor disavowed the notion of same-sex marriage. If indeed that fact is correct, those facts are correct, it suggests that the practice of religion simply is not tolerated. And so my question is, given the very high-sounding description in your commentary of providentialist versus secularist, when push comes to shove, are we faced with the reality that the practice of religion might indeed be unlawful in this country? I'd be interested in your response.
Now, do I have to push the star and pound, or can I am I online to respond?
Nope. Both both our speakers are live the whole time, so feel free to answer away.
Okay, good question. I haven't read about that particular incident, but one does hear about such things from time to time, and they are very distressing. I think we do face the possibility, in connection with issues like same-sex marriage, that different aspects of faith and practice will be subject to legal restrictions of various kinds, legal sanctions of various kinds. I think it would be premature at this point just to generalize and say, as you might have, I'm not sure if you meant to say, you know, that the practice of religion or certain kinds of religion is just sort of legally restricted or forbidden. I don't think we're at that point, but I do think we're definitely in the middle of a sort of a religious and cultural struggle about such things. A lot of people are quite uncertain about what they can do, what they can say, and so forth. It's a very, I think we live in very tumultuous and difficult times. That's why I think we do face the sorts of alternatives that I was trying to list. And different people will, you know, react differently to, you know, kind of the strategic question about what alternatives seem to be the most promising, or at least the least unpromising, perhaps. What do you think, John, on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just maybe a further complication is that in both directions, I mean, I think a lot of us like to think that there is a reasonable middle of a lot of Americans, but really in both directions, there are religious believers that want to push all the way to a kind of, let's say, Christian America, where laws are implemented in that form. And then conversely, there are people in the other direction who want to push all the way to the end of conservative religious belief and practice. And so in either direction, with at least two subsets of our country, there are really no limiting principles. And so it would be, I think, naive to think that this will just sort of end with the next decision, that there will always be tension in both directions. And right now it looks like in one direction the movement is moving.
Yeah, I think that's the worrisome thing for certain, you know, there may well be like Christian reconstructionists or certain kinds of Christian nation folks. I assume there are. I don't think there's any likelihood that in the courts or in voting they have any chance of succeeding in the foreseeable future. That there is much more of a worry that the other side will succeed in litigation and even perhaps in elections and so forth, which is a reason for concern now, I think.
All right. Well, we have one more pending question, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question, press star and then the pound key.
This is Matt McReynolds of Pacific Justice Institute. I want to thank both of you for a very informative teleforum today. And I wonder if I might ask somewhat of a more provincial question of Professor Smith based on your association with the West Coast. It seems like there's been quite a lot of debate over the decades and even centuries about our constitutional history centered in New England and the time of the Revolution. And what we're seeing somewhat more of in recent years is litigation that focuses on our state constitutional history. I think this happens a lot of places, but particularly here in the West, where there seems to be a real dearth of religious or constitutional history on the state level, and it seems to have developed in a kind of a parallel universe to what happened on the East Coast in the same time period. I'm wondering if you happen to have any recommended reading or resources for a better understanding of religious and constitutional history on the West Coast in general, and California in particular.
Well, that's a good question, although I'm afraid I'm the provincial one here, because I provincial in the sense that I don't pay a whole lot of attention to state constitutional developments and so forth. They've obviously become quite important in many respects. I mean, you mentioned, I might mention a couple that are, I think, fairly obvious. One was that in the aftermath of the Peyote case, the Smith decision, state protections for religious freedom, state RFRAs basically, I think have become more important. But under our Constitution, Supremacy Clause, and so forth, those aren't going to be of much use against federal laws and federal regulation and so forth. The other is just that here, where I live in San Diego now, when I moved here about 12 years ago or 13 years ago, there was already pending litigation. It had been pending for over 10 years, and I think it's still ongoing, about a cross that's on a high hill near in La Jolla, in the north part of San Diego, and will it ultimately be taken down? That's now being litigated, I think, under the U.S. constitutional doctrines, because the federal government eventually took over the land. But for about the first 15 years, it was being litigated mostly under, at least the decisions were mostly relying upon California constitutional provisions. Having said that, I still, myself, I just have to confess, have not devoted much study to the state, provision. So I'm not sure if there's some particular book or anything that goes into that or would be good. Maybe John does know of something, but I have to confess I'm not sure what I would recommend.
I can't help there. Sorry.
All right. Well, we now have one more question pending in about 10 minutes to go. So if you'd like to take the opportunity to ask one of our speakers, either or both of our speakers, a question, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, thank you for a very informed conversation. I have a couple of questions that are not related. One is, how does this Sharia law movement that's begun to spring up in U.S. courts, is more prevalent in European courts, impact any of your thinking affect it? And secondly, Philip Hamburger wrote a book about a dozen years ago that I read about a dozen years ago on separation of church and state, so I don't have a good recollection of the substance of his argument, but how does his thinking, at the time I read the book and thought it was groundbreaking and constitutional and historical principles that he discussed. How does Hamburger's thinking fit into the excellent analysis that both of you have presented today?
I guess I'll go first. I think if we're thinking globally and, you know, over the long term, the sort of old Samuel Huntington Clash of Civilizations thesis is something to take pretty seriously. And if anything, that's become more sort of frighteningly clear, I would think, in the last few years. The role of Islam in world history is very complicated and so forth. How to engage with that is going to be very important. I tend to be one who doesn't want to demonize here. I agreed a couple of years ago to be the faculty advisor to a Muslim student association at my law school, although it turned out there weren't enough people interested in it to get it going. But I think demonizing in general terms would be a very bad idea at this point. As far as though the Sharia law movement in the United States is concerned, I guess I would have to admit I have not studied it much, and I don't take it all that seriously. It seems to me it's more of a, you know, at this particular point in time, it's a little bit of a red herring where it comes up. I don't foresee any serious threat of Sharia law being imposed in any American jurisdictions, you know, in an unacceptable way.
If I could just comment on that point, I was suggesting on the Sharia law issue that it might well be a red herring that the secularists who have been very successful in the courts in this country against Protestant and Catholic religions might utilize to their political advantage.
Might use that to their, yeah. That could be right. I don't study that enough or follow it enough to comment in any significant way on those possibilities. But on your comment about or question about the Philip Hamburger book, I actually wrote a review in an obscure journal of that book at the time that I don't think I could even find myself anymore. The journal was so obscure, but I read that book when it came out. And had kind of a mixed reaction, an unusually mixed reaction, because on the one hand, I just thought it was a very impressive and admirable book. I had some conceptual difficulties with some of the argument that was made, however. But so I don't think the book. I think it's a very impressive book, worth reading. Contains a lot of fascinating information. And some of it's a little unsettling. I don't think it's had a huge impact on thinking among, you know, judges or lawyers or law professors about church-state relations. But it's certainly an impressive book, well worth reading. John probably knows the book too, and I don't know if you have a different take on it than I have. But
well, maybe I'll comment actually on the first question about the anti-Sharia law, and I'll put the comment even more forcefully. I think that Protestant conservatives are absolutely shooting themselves in the foot when they do political maneuvering or legal maneuvering that fails to honor and recognize the fact of pluralism in our society today. And so the political anti-Sharia law movements in Alabama and Oklahoma and other places, anti-Catholic sentiment that still exists, and other examples that we could go through. In fact, and Steve might have a different take on this, but I think the Town of Greece decision that validated local municipal prayer is an anti-pluralistic decision that does not help given the religious and other diversity in our country today. And the more that Protestant conservatives push these political and legal efforts, they're going to look around and have fewer allies when they make pluralist arguments on their own behalf. And so, Steve, I don't know if you have a different take on that, but I thought it was an important point to bring up.
I think you said it better than I did, more emphatically and probably deservedly so. You and I probably do have a little different opinion on the Town of Greece decision itself, but in general, I think you're right on that comment.
Well, this is Christian. We've got about 5 minutes left and one more question on the line, so we'll get to that and possibly have time for one more after that, but we'll at least get to our one pending question.
Hi. I have a general question about the categories that you were discussing, the providentialism and secularism.
Right.
Part of the I think, divergence between old times and new is that although many people might be believers in God and adherents to, let's say, the Ten Commandments or as a baseline, they would not be adhere to the particular practices the different religions have set up as essential, so that you would not be justified in calling such people secular, and they obviously would not fit into your providentialism category, but they are clearly believers. So when people object in general to these special exemptions that are carved out for particular practices, it may not be because they object to religion or the expression or even belief in religion, which they hold. These are objections to the deification or the religious making of particular practices that they no longer or they never saw as essentially connected to a belief in God and the concept of this country as based on Christian principles, Judeo-Christian, if you like.
Yeah. So that's a really good comment. So let me start off by saying, I think I did mention this in my opening remarks, and I try and stress it in the book as well, that the categories are overly simplified and crude and to some degree inaccurate. I think they can provide a basis for discussing and understanding what's happened, but we have to understand that they are too crude. For example, just to mention, I put Jefferson in the secularist category, and I think secularists have always wanted to claim Jefferson as some sort of champion, you know, and separationists and so forth. But that's an anachronistic sort of label for him. He wouldn't have called himself that, secularist. And I think something like Daniel Boorstin's book on The Lost World of Thomas Jefferson emphasizes how thoroughly, in many ways, providentialist, you might say, Jefferson's whole worldview was. But I think it's still fair to call him secularist along these divides in that he did favor more of a separation between religion and government. He didn't, he's actually still basically prayed and invoked deity in his inaugural addresses, but he didn't want to proclaim a national day of prayer, et cetera. So he was more on the secular side than, say, someone like Washington or John Adams was. And you're just trying to find the labels to make that sort of distinction. Now today, so there are a lot of people, I think, who would probably be more on the secular side with respect to their attitudes towards government, law, and politics, and maybe that's what you have in mind, who nonetheless are, religious believers of various kinds. Some might be quite devout and even orthodox in their faith, but nonetheless favor more of a secularist approach to government. So that category can include a lot of people. I emphasize it is not an anti-religious category. I mean, it can include people, obviously, who are anti-religious, but it is not inherently anti-religious and so forth. The last thing, though, I think I might want to say about your comment is something that troubles, this does trouble me a little, because you do find people, I think, who say, I take it they're sincere, you know, say, I'm a religious person in some sense. Some people say I'm spiritual but not religious. Of course, that's kind of a common slogan. But others would say, I'm religious. I believe in God. Maybe I even go to church and so forth. But when it comes to any specific protection for anybody's religious practice, aren't in favor of that. I run into people fairly often, I think, who will, when I'm giving a talk on one thing or another, say, I'm all for religious freedom, but I don't think that means that someone should be able to act as an employer on their belief that abortion is wrong, or something like that. That becomes, in my view, it risks becoming pretty meaningless at some point. You know, I'm all for religious freedom, just not in practice when it ever matters. You know, when it matters to somebody whose religious views are out of line with sort of dominant consensuses or my own views. I'm not real sympathetic to that sort of view, if that's the kind of thing that you have in mind.
I think I said it mainly to attempt to convince you not to be so pessimistic.
Oh, yeah, but I don't know if it succeeded in that, because when I encounter that, it makes me more pessimistic, you know, when I encounter people. And these can be law professors who are themselves religious and think that they're committed to religious freedom. But then I'll hear people say, but, you know, most Catholics don't even believe there's anything wrong with contraception, so what's the big deal? Sometimes there's a shocking inability of people who regard themselves as religious and think that they're in favor of religious freedom to understand, yeah, but some people do believe that, you know, and that's what religious freedom is about. You know, not everybody does, but some people do. That is the sort of phenomenon that I sometimes find a little bit distressing.
Well, this is Christian Corgan back. We've reached the end of the hour, so I think we'll wrap things up. I want to extend a special thank you to both Professor Smith as well as Professor Nazu for joining us. A reminder that the book is called The Rise and Decline of American Religious Freedom. It's on Amazon.com as well as bookstores, and I believe on the Teleform announcement we provided a link to that as well. Thank you to our audience for listening in. One reminder that you can listen to the podcast of this Teleform call on our website to be posted within a couple days, anytime at fedsoc.org, as well as all of our previous Teleform conference calls that are posted. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.